Okay. So, good morning. It is September 23rd at about 10 a.m. at the offices of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. This is Ron Borzakowski, the Deputy Research Director here. And we're here with Professor John Taylor of Stanford University, who's kind enough to join us this morning, and with
Scott Gans.
And just for the record, Professor, you're comfortable with our recording this conversation?
Yes.
Thank you. So given that you were here earlier and we've gotten to read some of this, I guess if you could just start, I think the easiest thing to do is with, you know, a rough overview of your view of the crisis, and in particular if it's changed in any way since you first spoke to the commissioners and wrote your book, and any new insights you may have had since then, and we'll just carry a conversation from that point.
Yeah, last time I spoke to the commission was in the fall of last year, and I believe it was in October. And then did some follow-up questions, which I submitted in November. And so that was a year ago. And I guess just to get the beginning of your question a little bit, yeah, a lot has transpired in the last year. Many more papers have been written, much more research, myself, many other people. So I think we have learned more. I'll try to get into that. But basically, my view about the crisis has not changed fundamentally. I would say I've always stressed, and even before the crisis blew up, the very low interest rates set at the Fed and other central banks. That's one of the things we've learned about. But at the Fed in particular, and I originally did that research in the summer, spring and summer of 2007 for a meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And the request for me originally from the Kansas City Fed, who sponsored the Congress, could you write a paper on the relationship between monetary policy and housing? And so what I did was study the connection between the very low interest rates, which when I say very low, I'm really measuring that relative to what had been transpired in the previous 20 years or so, sometimes measured by a so-called Taylor rule, but low relative to what policy would have been under similar conditions based on my calculations in the past 20 or so years, which were good times, by the way, sometimes called the Great Moderation. So I found those interest rates being low, and then built a little model that connected those low interest rates to housing starts in particular, but also housing prices. And it was a pretty stable relationship, a simple one. It wasn't a full econometric model, which I've done in the past, but this was just focusing on housing. And I found if you did a counterfactual simulation, that the boom in housing construction starts would have been much more mild. Might not even call it a boom. And the bust as well would be mild, might not even call it a bust, but basically the whole thing attenuated significantly. If interest rates had been higher, and in particular closer to what I estimate, they would have been based on experience of most of the 80s and the 90s. And that basic result, I think, has held up quite well. It's been analyzed by many people. I think one of the first ones was a paper by out of the ECB, Frank Smets is the research director there, you know, and he did a paper with colleague Jarosinski, which was published in the St. Louis Fed Review. It was presented there, and what they did was a big study, statistical study that looked for the relationship between low interest rates measured relative to what they would be historically, and housing saw a significant effect. Soon thereafter, there was a study at the OECD, I really give you references to all these things, and they looked at this hypothesis internationally, actually within the OECD countries, and found, I thought, a remarkably strong relationship between the low interest rates and housing construction, residential construction, measures of booms in the OECD countries. And so since then, so that was really, I think, all in existence when I testified here at the commission a year ago. So since then, we've had more. I'll just mention a couple of other things if you'd like me to.
Please.
Yeah. So there was a study by another Federal Reserve official, Kansas City, George Kahn, who looked at what he sometimes calls them Taylor Rule residuals, which looked at the relationship between those and other, and basically housing prices, housing boom in the United States, focused on the United States. There was another study by the OECD which supported their earlier study. There was another vector autoregression type of thing, which was, sorry to use that term earlier, that's what Smets used. Another one came out of the ECB, found similar results to Smets. So I think there's been quite a few. Another interesting thing of this, which I haven't stressed, didn't originally stress, but I think was clear when things really got moving in the crisis. Because remember, this original work was before the crisis blew up. But that was really this examination between the low interest rates and what I think is sometimes called the search for yield more generally. That the low interest rates encouraged people to take more risks because they needed to get their yields up a little bit for measures of performance. And there's papers written on that, actually. Raghu Rajan has stressed that, and there's some statistical work on that. So that's all the supportive side. There's maybe one more, what I consider supportive, although sometimes characterized differently. Just very recently, this summer, at another Jackson Hole meeting 3 years later, there was a paper by Charlie Bean of the Bank of England deputy governor. And he did another vector autoregression. There's quite a few. And he found that in the UK and the US now, somewhat surprising for the UK because people had thought it was interest rates weren't so low, but this vector autoregression showed that lower interest rates compared to normal did have this impact on housing prices. He described them as modest. I'd actually discussed the paper and found them not to be quite so modest, but but whatever, they're in the, and I think certainly significant in the right direction. Okay, then sort of on the other side, what I've noticed is, say just this year in January, Ben Bernanke gave a speech at the American Economic Association. And I think his main argument was, well, rates really weren't low relative to the Taylor rule, and he used that term. If you put in forecasts of inflation, what we thought the inflation rate would have been, we meaning the Fed, thought the inflation rate would be at the time. And so that was actually a sort of an explanation based on the rate really weren't so low relative to normal. I think Don Cohn had written about that earlier. Maybe soon after I wrote my first paper, but whatever, it's demonstrated that. And so I responded to that by saying, well, the whole purpose of these rules was not to use forecasts, but to use the actual values, and moreover, your forecasts were wrong at the time. They were too optimistic, and so I think in some sense that's more evidence that rates were too low. There was also, simultaneous with that speech, a staff study at the Fed, about seven people were involved, and they basically explained that position. And then they looked at vector autoregressions themselves, similar to the Smets and the Bean and the others I mentioned. They also looked at some international work here referring to the IMF. They didn't refer to any of these other studies I mentioned, by the way, but the OECD study, for example, was not mentioned. And they also found internationally a relationship between low rates and housing, but said it wasn't significant in a statistical sense. So I think that's basically where it is. So overall, I think what I've read is pretty supportive. I can't read everything. Right at this point, there's so much written on this particular hypothesis and, of course, other alternative hypotheses. But I think, if I might say, it seems to me that people like you are trying to get to the bottom of all this. It's really important to consider the entire body of work that's done. so often when I read a piece, they refer to the viewpoints that support what they, and don't mention the others. And that's not a way to get a better understanding or an agreement. I probably do that myself to some extent, but I try not to. But I think the more that someone, people in your position here at the commission, can bring all the stuff together and say, look, you know, the facts are the facts. We should be able to come to a view here on the significance of at least the monetary policy side in the U.S. and in other countries. So there's where you have it. You mentioned other causes. I think I've begun to think that the, mentioned this originally in my work, that the Fannie and Freddie support for more risky mortgages than was known at the time. I think we know more about the fact that they were actually purchasing riskier mortgages, and the work has been done about that. I think we also know that there were some regulators that were not watching carefully about some of the banks when they bought these risky mortgages. I, for example, the New York Fed, of course, has many regulators at the major banks, and for a while at some of the investment banks, hundreds of regulators. And how could Citi have purchased all these risky, toxic assets, which we call now, with all these regulators there? And so I think they're sort of learning more about the process. So it's while I think the low rates were a very powerful macro force, they most likely made some of these other factors more significant. Just for example, on the Fannie and Freddie, the ability to issue variable rate mortgages with the very low teaser rates obviously had some relationship with the 1% federal funds rate. And the search for yield, which I think led to more risky behavior at the banks, at least some banks, not all banks, of course, was to some extent related to those low interest rates. So that's what how I view the situation now.
No, that's great. To follow up, I mean, I find this, your original work using housing starts, I want to think about this a little bit. I can see why the low rates housing starts correlation, which I don't know if you report the correlation coefficient, but the regression is cited in the work.
Yeah, I have actually all this stuff in somewhere, so if anything you want about numbers, I'd be very happy to give you this as well. It's very well documented.
But you mentioned also that you had the same effect on prices, because I'm thinking about, you mentioned the Rajan work, which is more about the sort of search for yield.
Mm-hmm.
And these strike me as, the housing start seems to be a supply measure of some sort in housing, and the Rajan work seems to be the search for yield, and people buying assets is sort of a demand for the mortgage mm-hmm. paper. And the prices seem to be the equilibrium outcome of that.
Yeah, of course, when you look at a quantity like starts or just the value put in place, that's supply and demand, right? You can look at inventories, but basically, just in a market, you see a quantity. You maybe want to look at inventories and try to sift that. But if you look, supply and demand for apples, you can see the amount of apples purchased. That's the quantity. So your question about shouldn't it be supply, I think no, not necessarily. And in fact, the way I've always thought about the housing cycle going way back, we used to have big housing cycles before the Great Moderation especially the 70s, but also the 60s. I thought of that as demand. Basically, the Fed would lower interest rates and raise interest rates. Sometimes it would cause this, through the regulation queue, disintermediation, people would have trouble getting credit, and so housing demand would fluctuate. So if you think about models, whether it's the old models or the newer models, the housing component is usually thought of as a demand, at least the ups and downs. Now, I know the longer term, it's got to be, you have to have the supply there, and it is a equilibrium, supply and demand. But like so many things in macroeconomics and the business cycle, the ups and downs, the shorter-term fluctuations, there's a lot, I think, appropriate focus on fluctuations in demand, and that's how I was thinking of those regressions relating interest rates to housing starts.
So should I think about this as interest rates? There's a low interest rate environment, in particular in combination with a greater percentage of ARM mortgages tied to those lower rates. That's going to stimulate consumer demand for both houses and then presumably for financing. Mm-hmm. And the housing starts are the sort of supply response to that. So in effect, what they're picking up is a sort of lag demand of something of some sort. Because some people argue starts just come after, you know, builders see demand from the consumer side, and that's where you see housing starts coming, just because building takes a little while. You have time
to build.
Well, of
course, some houses don't take that long to build.
This has been an issue among many people we've spoken to at the commission, whether how strong a supply constraint, in particular, like, you know, the Vegas markets or the Central Valley in California.
Well, it varies. You have tremendous evidence across the country on that. You have California, where I live, more supply constrained in certain areas and less in others. You have for various zoning reasons. You have Texas, very little, and so you saw much more of a housing boom in California than you did in Texas. So there definitely, if you're thinking about it, you know, the demand shifting up because of the, for housing shifting up because of these lower interest rates, the more supply is constraining in the short run, the more you're going to see a rise in price. And I think that's, there's a lot of evidence of that across the states in the U.S.
Have you seen evidence for, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me, the Miami's, the Manhattan effect, right, where there's absolutely a tremendous supply constraint, or San Francisco, where there's no place left to build. I mean, have you seen evidence in the Central Valley at all, which is some of the largest price spikes from the Central Valley in California, where people, the view is there's infinite farmland.
Infinite what?
Farmland that you could always convert from cotton or carrots over.
Well, that's where a lot of the speculation building was. I don't have data on, I have at least studied it, between the Central Valley and the coast. I mean, there's, you know, I live on the coast, and there's really not, even yet, not much of a price decline. I think that's a scarcity aspect. You even understand that in nice areas of London, there's almost no impact of a decline in prices. So there is definitely, I mean, I think supply and demand works, and if there's a constraint on supply, you're going to see a rise in prices without much construction. And if you have room to build, and the zoning is pretty liberal, then you're going to see smaller price increases and more of a supply response. But I think just your question is very good about when you look at starts. Is it supply or demand? I think of it in terms of explaining the ups and downs as really demand. If you look at, you know, look at the data, these estimates that I did back in summer of 2007, I estimated those equations way back when. It wasn't just because I wanted to be sure they were stable, in the sense the relationship between the funds rate, which is, there's a long connection between the funds rate and starts and prices, but I wanted to be sure that was pretty stable. So I estimated it during the earlier period, the more volatile period, and the later period, which was less volatile. Surprisingly, the coefficient was very stable, surprising to me and a lot of other people. But that certainly the earlier part, where we had lots of ups and downs in the housing market, I think is viewed as shifts in demand because of monetary policy. You think about monetary policy, the way we think of it works usually is through the demand, right? Interest rates make it easier to borrow, so people buy more cars. I mean, that's the whole, you know, the idea of stimulate the economy through monetary policy is thought to work through demand, for right or for wrong, and I think that's correct. And so the housing side of this is really the same view completely.
Although, yes, what I'm trying to think about in terms of housing, though, right, at least in the days of the 30-year fixed mortgages, those are priced, you know, at least we tend to think of them priced off the longer end of the yield curve.
Yes.
Of the 10-year, right? So you need, to get the connection between, let's say, the Fed funds rate and mortgage finance, you need a connection between the short end and the long end. And I guess part of the Bernanke argument was that at least through the 2000s, some of this had disconnected, right? So,
well, particularly on the Greenspan. I don't recall Ben Bernanke
perhaps
emphasizing
Greenspan,
that was really, that's Greenspan. And by the way, I think the initial response to my analysis came from Greenspan. He wrote several pieces about it. Actually, most recently, a Brookings piece, but originally a Wall Street Journal piece. And I talked to him many, many, many times about this. And his view is quite different from Bernanke's. First, as you say, he views there was this disconnect between movements in the short rate and the longer rate. Okay, so let's focus on that just for a few minutes. There's no question when the short rate started to rise, you didn't see as much of an increase in the long rate. I think that that doesn't mean that the term structure of interest rates, that is the relationship between expectations of future short rates and long rates, is incorrect. I think it had something to do with people thinking, well, this interest rate is so low, what's the story here? Is it going to come up? When's it going to come up? And I think that actually, if you like, affected the rules of thumb that people use in looking at the term structure. When you remember the policy of the Fed for most of the 80s and 90s until this period was pretty predictable. The interest rates rising and falling with inflation in the economy, not perfect. So this was an unusual period. I don't think there's any question the Fed even would talk about rates being extra low and coming up more slowly. So the question is, how would that affect rules of thumb for long-term bond pricing? And I think they could certainly confuse people because what is the future here? But in addition, I think it could reduce the impact of an increase in short rates and the long rates because you don't know that it's going to be a typical interest rate cycle. So that has to do with that connection. And a related point on that issue is that I think, as you mentioned, that the adjustable rate mortgages, which are keyed off the short rate, are also a factor. And in particular, during this period, a growing factor. I mean, if you look at the share of mortgages that were adjustable rate, they rose dramatically, and then they came back down again. So these low rates, seem to be associated with more adjustable rate mortgages. I think it got to be about 30% of the market. I can give you the specific data if you like. So that's, in some sense, independent of this long rate effect. Okay, so that's that connection. Then Greenspan would also say that the long rates were really much more influenced by international considerations than the past. So you had more of a integration of capital markets, and so the fact that interest rates were low globally kept the Fed from raising the longer rates. So that now, that of course is related to this debate about the so-called global savings club. Okay, so savings globally were not high in this period. I have some plots I can show you that they were low globally. There's no question you can savings rates were low globally.
They were rising, but from very very low levels.
Very low. Yeah, I mean it's hard to point to that in this episode when they were higher in the 80s, higher in the 70s, way but much higher. Okay, so the global savings glut in that definition doesn't make sense, and Alan Greenspan recognizes that. So he would interpret it. He describes it a little differently. He would say, well, it's not so much saving and investment, it's intended saving and investment, or desired saving and investment. And the low interest rates were most likely due to the fact that intended investment was lower than saving. So that if you think of the desired amount, this is an expectations-oriented argument. It's undoubtedly got some truth to it. And so you'd have to get the low interest rates because of a global thing, and I think you should think about it globally, by the way. But to get the low interest rates globally thing, you'd have to find a way that investment demand globally would be intended to be less than savings. We don't just have evidence of that. So we just can't. I don't think we can prove that one way or the other. That's a speculation. So I tend not to focus on that as a reason. Okay, so then what else? The other global savings glut, the version of global savings glut, it had to do with the international distribution of saving. Yes. So not so much the low global savings is that, or high global savings. It was that savings was high in China and the Middle East and low in the United States. And somehow that causes a flow of funds into mortgages and keeps the interest rates low. I think that's inconsistent with the view of a global capital market. So I tend to sympathize more with Greenspan's view. You have interest capital flows, and so it's going to affect yields all over the place, all over the world, wherever capital can flow to. And so you need to have some other explanation to get the low interest rates globally. you can't have it just the money, the funds shift from one country to another, because that doesn't affect the total. So, for what it's worth, I don't emphasize, I don't think there's much validity to the idea that the these capital flows or current account imbalances have played a big role here. Others have argued that it is a factor. I just put much less emphasis on that.
Okay. Yeah, because the argument has been that there's either demand for dollar-denominated assets or for particularly, you know, safe dollar-denominated assets, which would have kept rates low, I guess, for treasuries, for agency securities, and then in particular for the AAA tranches of structured products, be they mortgages or structured loan products or the like. But you apparently don't...
Well, I think you want to think about it as a global market. It is. But money. That's, the argument is that it's global, so money rushes in. But if it's global, it should depend on the total amount of savings and investment in the world.
So presumably, if yields dropped here, then people would have, you know, the money should have flowed somewhere else to where yields were higher, to our Argentinian debt.
Those yields down, yes, exactly. And you have the different risk all the time, and those are moving around. But exactly right, exactly right.
I haven't seen anyone do a sort of econometric analysis of some kind of risk return.
Globally? You know,
globally. Supply and demand for different currency denominated or internationally generated analysis.
I haven't either. Early on there was a study at the Bank of Canada, I don't think I referred to it in my book, which looked at the global savings and investment mix, but it did not have, it wasn't a formal analysis like you're talking about.
Yeah, I've seen, I'm glad to hear that you haven't seen these either, because we've seen this, I don't want to sound pejorative, so I won't say hand-waving, but more qualitative discussions of these issues. But I don't think I've yet seen the sort of econometric work. Going back a little bit, I want to ask one question. The period of low interest rates is in 2002, 2003, where people have argued for the violation of the Taylor Rule. House prices, when you look at them in the U.S., had started rising earlier. So is it your view that there may have actually been, for a variety of reasons, and if you have any ideas what they might be, a structural break in house prices, that perhaps from 97 to 2003, that rise in prices was driven by fundamentals or some other factors, and that it's the that's sort of a bubble?
Definitely. It was a takeoff during that period, and you can see it in the data. It rose a lot more rapidly during this period than before, but there was definitely something going on before in terms of housing prices, but this period was much more like a bubble.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And by the way, the word bubble, of course, not necessarily the right word to use, but we know what is this extraordinary rise in prices and then a collapse. Yeah.
Right. It's always hard to know. This is a very big debate about either in real time or even ex post whether it's in fact a bubble, and whether you should measure relative to rents, relative to construction costs. Relative, what a fundamental price is, of course, is hard if you believe supply and demand sets the price.
Right.
It's very hard to write about that from a purely neoclassical point of view, because these things...
It is, yeah.
Without going to expectations equilibria, these things shouldn't happen, and yet they do. Do you have other questions about house prices and the monetary policy side? Because there are other...
I guess, how about on the other side? When interest rates began to sort of, I guess, did the relationships remain consistent even during the period of rising interest rates?
The regressions I did then went covered that period, I believe, though it's a relatively short period, so you don't know if it's consistent. But you did definitely, when rates rose, you had the reverse happening, right? You had housing prices coming down, and of course starts coming down. So that's in the data. There's no question about it. I think overall there's quite a bit of stability in the coefficients in these relationships. That's what I found. So I think it is definitely. So in a way, the low rates is a typical thing with the monetary policy, that these booms and busts are caused because rates get very low for one reason, and then the central bank has to undo that, and then you get the reverse side. So the boom and the bust, which we had, was very common in the 70s. So rates got low because usually the Fed got concerned about unemployment, so rates got low, and then inflation started to pick up, and so they raised rates, and that sort of caused things to come back down again. Anyway, you can see what I mean. Probably not getting my signs right here in this explanation, but if you look at the boom-bust cycle in throughout monetary history, the best recent example was the 70s, you see this same kind of phenomenon.
Are you sympathetic to the argument that there was, that there may have been, I guess the answer is going to have to be no in a rules versus discretion kind of world, but to the, you know, rates were low because of deflationary fears in 2002, 2003, the very slow pace of the recovery coming out of the recession, even with the mild trough. And that this current argument that says with only one or possibly two levers of monetary policy, you can't fight both the asset bubble and the dual mandate of the Fed.
Well, actually, get some water or coffee or something.